Well, where is my life going? That's a good question, isn't it? It's going somewhere. If you were Seinfeld, you'd say, where's my life going? Well, it's going somewhere. You know? Sorry, I'm not as good as Jerry Seinfeld. But we wonder, where is life? Life is full of transitions. Life is full of going from here to there to there to here. A whole range of different things. We are born, we grow up. Some of us might get educated. Some of us might get married. Some of us may not. Some of us might have different things happen in our lives. Some of us might have children. Some of us may not. We go through our lives in different ways and different experiences, don't we? We can't compare my life to your life or your life to mine because they're so different. We're all on different pathways. And yet that's what we tend to do, isn't it? We tend to compare, oh, that person seemed to have a pretty good life. Why haven't I got a life like that? And we keep looking over the fence, often at others. And we go through our lifespan from when we're first born to when we grow up to when we get older to when we die. Some of us may not have that arc of life, may not go through and get that opportunity of that full lifespan as others may do. But what we do have is a chance to ask, what do I do with the time that I do have? What do I do with the time I do have? Where is my life going? Well, I want you to sort of think about that for a minute. What is the activity that you most do in your life? Think about that. What do you think is the second activity that you spend the most time in your life? And the third, okay? Have a little think. Okay, I spend most of my time doing this. Probably then I spend most time doing this, and then the most time I do this. Well, our next slide. This is a survey that was done between 2009 and 2016. By the OECD, and they used a time-based data system recorded between people aged 15 to 64 throughout the world. And in the 1,440 minutes that you get in a day, they diarized what they did with their time, they collated that over the 7 years, and they came up with these results. Now, I haven't given you the answers, and the people up the back can't answer this because they can see the next slide and they know the answer. And my wife can't answer this because she already knows the answers too. But I want you to talk with someone next to you and think, what is the highest that most people spend their time in their 1440 minutes in a day, okay? And then what would probably be about the second and what would be the third, okay? Talk to the person next to you, get the top three, and Rob will give you a present later on. Okay, had enough time. Let's come back. Okay.
To people, and I can.
I'm going to survey the room. If you don't want to be part of the survey, that's fine. You might feel like, oh, I don't want to be seen as wrong. That's okay. It really depends what country you're from, actually. So, you know, but we are working off Australia at the moment, but you can compare to the world. Okay. This is the OECD data. Okay. Who has the answer for the top? Who thinks what it is? Yep. Okay. What's the answer? Work is number one. Okay. Interesting. Sleep. What was that one? Pondering. Okay. I can let you know that sleep is the top answer. And that's good coming from a younger person, you know, because obviously, you know, that's the reality when you're younger. You think, oh, just want to sleep. Okay, so number one is sleep. What do you think was number two? Work, correct, yeah. Let's pull down the answer. The next slide, please. You can see the breakdown here. This is sleep. And sorry, you can't see all the different countries and compare them, but sleep is number one. Nearly, you know, 512 minutes of your 1,440 minutes is spent on sleep on average in Australia. So the ones who didn't get as much sleep in the world were the South Africans. Isn't that fascinating? Any South Africans here today? So, yeah, you don't sleep as much. Maybe you need to get a bit more. Big shout out to the South Africans. And the second one is your work minutes. So paid work we're talking about here, which is this line. Now, if you added in housework and other unpaid work, obviously that's another about a third of your time is spent in some form of work or domestic sort of work in that way. And I wanted to encourage us, when we think of work, we think of it widely because our society is really good at saying you are a commodity. Your work, your paid work is significant, and we want to stand against that narrative because that is not the narrative of the Bible, is it? The Bible actually looks at work a lot broader, and we'll be looking at that in a little bit today. What do you think the third might be? If you take out those domestic ones, what do you think was the most of those. Correct, it is. It's watching and listening radio and TV. Fascinating, isn't it? 140 minutes spent on that. And it was the second highest in the USA. So that's also fascinating too. They've had live streaming services longer than we have in Australia, so that makes sense. So what you do with your time is significant. We can either fit into the norms, or we can think, well, what are we going to do with the time that we have? Our next slide reminds us how long we've got on average. So if you're a male, you've got about, 81.3 years on average, 85.4 for females. We all know that women live longer than men. We know that. We have caught up men recently, though, haven't we? You know, with a lot of the medical sciences and stuff coming through and medications and stuff. We're catching up. There might be something we're equal with women on. I don't know. But what are we going to do with our time? You've got 81.3. Some people are over that now, I'm sure, within this room. 85.4 if you're female. Some of you may be over that age. You've gone past. You've got extra time. We don't know what's going to happen today. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But we do know right at this point in time, we have a choice. This is a chance for us to think about what are we doing. Now, some people want to expand themselves. They want to spend all their time and all their energy and all their effort and all their thinking around exercise, good eating, make sure we've got this right, make sure we limit our stress, and we spend a lot of time on just their own health, spiritually, mentally, physically, and they're good things. But we can be so consumed with that, can't we? And there's people in our world, you read the papers, there seems to be a lot about that in the world, because there's, what else is there about life? I wonder if we stopped and we actually thought within the cacophony of the noises around us, the distractions in the world around us, the stream services, the voices that are saying to us, live like this, buy this, do this. I wonder if we actually stopped for a minute and thought and were reflective about what is actually going on in our world. Because that's what the book of Ecclesiastes actually does. It forces us to stop, to think, to ruminate, to meditate, to contemplate on what is happening in my world and in the world in which I find myself and in my living. The Bible talks about a Sabbath day of rest. You've heard that thing? Have you heard this thing called the Sabbath? Sabbath is the Hebrew word sabbat. Sabbat means to stop. Today, right now, is a chance for you to stop, as the writer of this book is helping us to try and understand. But our society wants to distract you from doing that. There's a book by Charles Hummel back in 1994. Okay, it's a few decades ago. He talked back then, over 40 years ago, in a book called Tyranny of the Urgent. You can imagine what that was talking about. The doing and doing and doing and forgetting to stop. This is the challenge that has been going for over four decades and even more so. You see, we need to fight to stop. We see that picture in the Old Testament, don't we, in the book of Exodus, as the people of God are being brought out of Egypt. It's a fight for the Sabbath, a fight for rest, wasn't it? There's a need for us to stand against the narrative of our society to stop and think, what am I doing with my time? See, the writer of this book challenges us with where is your life going? What are you doing in this world? It pervades this notion that time matters. We live in an upside-down type of world. Time, in a sense, is a commodity. Our work, our leisure, the use of our time are important. They've got value, haven't they? I don't want to sort of challenge your senior pastor too much, but we're not sure that this book was written by Solomon. The Hebrew word for teacher in chapter 1 is koheleth, which means teacher. But when we read this book and we unravel it, it's actually written in a Persian and Assyrian type of language around the 4th century BC, not 10th century BC, when Solomon lived. So there is some contention about that. Oh, is it written by Solomon? Does it matter? Actually, it could be someone who took on the personification of Solomon and lived as though they were the king, which was a normal sort of practice in those days. Go to Morling. Find out more about that if you're interested in that. An understanding. There's a little nudge from Morling there. Tick the box. But Ecclesiastes 1 really sets the tone for this book. And I want to encourage you, once you finish our service today, go home, read Ecclesiastes. I think this is a book that we each need to read at least annually. At least annually, to say, yep, this is my week where I'm reading Ecclesiastes, and I'm going to stop and I'm going to reflect, and we're going to call it a retreat, we're going to call it whatever it is, but I'm going to stand against the narrative of our society. I'm going to have this time because I know God wants to speak to me and work in my life. And Ecclesiastes 1 is interesting because it shows the hamster wheel that we're on. The sun comes up, the sun goes down. We sleep, we work, we eat. The sun comes up, the sun comes down. We see this circular motion set in tone in the very first chapter of Ecclesiastes. And it can bring you to this sort of, the boredom of life. Do you know what I mean? You know that I'm on the hamster wheel. Because we know what tomorrow is for those who do paid work, don't we? And we don't want to mention that word because it's quite a rude word sometimes. It's called Monday. So we've got to be really thinking that we're in this book with this person, with this writer Koheleth. And he sums it up as he talks about this constancy, this repetitiveness. He talks about that all is meaningless. The Hebrew word there is hebel, which means vanity, chasing after the wind, meaningless. It's like, bleh, I don't know. It's that type of thing. Hebel. If we go to the next slide and we move into chapter 3, which we didn't read before, I love this chapter because it reminds us of the scattergun that Ecclesiastes gives us. It's like a scattergun. It just shoots here, shoots there, shoots there. It's just all around the place, and your head is just in all sorts of places. So don't be surprised at the end of this message, you're left with, man, I've just got all these things spinning around, because that's what Ecclesiastes does, because we don't always have time to stop, think, pray, reflect. Let's stand against that narrative. Let's think of Ecclesiastes 3:1-8. A predominant image is what we do with our time, and this gives us a little bit of a summation of what that time can look like. And it gives us sort of these poles between here and here of the expression of time. Because there is a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born, a time to die. A time to plant, a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. We're not really quite sure what that actually means. The others seem quite logical when we're sort of thinking, what does it mean to scatter stones? And there are some different ideas that it could be, you know how you leave a field fallow and they put stones on it to stop any weeds coming up and left it fallow? It could be that. Or it could be an enemy has put all these stones on your field so you can't grow. Could be that. And then there's a time to gather them back up. It could be an image of hoarding, like there's a time to gather stuff and a time to let go. We're not sure. Anyway, go to Morling, you'll find out the answer. Verse 5, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep, a time to throw away. A time to tear, a time to mend. A time to be silent. And a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. Turn to someone again and ask what stood out. Tell them what stood out for you in that list. What stood out for you in that time? So now if there's someone nearby who hasn't got someone to talk to, go and grab them and say, hey, what did you grab out of that? What stood out for you? Okay? Share. What is it that stood out for you in the time that you have from that? Okay, has everyone had a chance to share something? Something that stood out for them? I'm sure you were able to give examples of each of those. It's quite interesting as you sit and reflect and ponder each one of those things and consider, well, when's it appropriate? Well, when's the right time to be born, time to die? And as you go through it, you know, talking with someone else, you actually find there is a time for everything. I did this at some other churches and, someone said, yeah, there's a time to get rid of old habits, that you kill off old habits. And I thought, wow, that's a beautiful way of looking at it. So instead of seeing it in a physical killing, there was this sort of killing off something that wasn't healthy in your life. So, you know, there's great ways of interpreting this. And I think the writer of Ecclesiastes has done that for a reason, to help us to think of our life situation, our context, as we apply the realities of that. And these things fly through. You see, our life is full of all sorts of anomalies and disparities. Things converge, things diverge. There's a whole range of different things, and life can be a bit like a black mirror. It's like this brokenness where we can't see as it should be, and our world is darkened in the way that things should be expressed. What should happen doesn't. The older people who we see sometimes are so horrible and evil and think, how do they get that old? And then beautiful young people die and we go, what? How can that be? And why has that person got all that money and that person doesn't, and they do more for God than that person? And do you know what I'm saying? The world is full of anomalies and we just can't quite see. And it's interesting as you think of this concept that our world sometimes can be a bit like a black mirror, a bit cracked, a bit dark in different spaces and places. I'm not advocating this, but on Netflix is a series called Black Mirror. Anyone seen it? The new season's just come out. I suggest that you've got to be into psychologically deformed and deranged material if you want to watch it. Although it's got some really good messages other than that. So be prepared. I wouldn't be showing your children necessarily this, but if you were able to cope with that, it's really challenging. And one of the recent series, I won't tell you the answer, but one of the recent series is, you know how when you sign up to like a Netflix or an insurance policy, or you sign up to an app or something, you tick a box and you just tick it and you think, I'm not going to read that 20-page thing about what it is. Well, the first one in the new season is basically that. And, you know, someone ticks a box and how bad it went, because legally this person was had ticked the box, you know. And it's quite fascinating to think, oh, gosh, yeah, the things that happen in our life to us are sometimes outside of our control. And similarly, Ecclesiastes paints that picture. There's things in the world that seem outside of our control that come upon us. In fact, the book of Ecclesiastes, if you had picked up some of the narrative already and some of the words in the readings we've done, really are about connecting to our work and what we do in our world. And there's a clear connection to Genesis 1 to 3. You see, when we're talking about this book of the Bible, it's called wisdom literature. And the whole of creation was created through God's wisdom. And so there's these clear connections between Genesis 1 to 3, particularly chapter 3, and the work motif and the metaphor there and the understanding of work that we see and the brokenness of work in Genesis 3 when the humanity sinned. And, you know, now there's sweat and toil and all those sort of things as you work now, and things aren't as easy as they once were. You plant some things in the ground and you get all these weeds around it. And I mean, you look at that image and we think, wow, it's far from us. We're not in an agrarian lifestyle now. But the whole stress and the turmoil and the angst that we see in Genesis 3 is definitely here projected into Ecclesiastes. And so it reminds us and asks us again and again, where is my life going? As we contemplate my work, my rest, my eating, my sleeping, my lack of sleeping, as I struggle and get stressed about life, where am I in life? Well, the next slide reminds us of that. This is an infographic by Mark McCrindle. I'm not sure if you've seen this before, so you have to get out your telescope if you want to see it. But trust me, I can read out some of that. This is some research done by Mark McCrindle, who's a Christian social researcher. And he has looked at some stats of those who are considered Gen Z, which is people born between 1995 and 2009. And the typical person within that generation will have 18 jobs, 6 careers, okay, so that's training for 6 careers, and live in 15 different homes in their lifetime. Now, some of us older ones are thinking, man, I don't know whether I could do 6 careers, let alone 18 jobs and 15 homes. Some of you may have, but a lot of us in the older generations don't think that. We don't experience that. But those experiences are going to form this next generation coming through. And then you've got Gen Alpha, which are, you know, quite young at the moment. What is going to happen for them? So this next infographic shows some of the breakdown of the generations. So you've got Gen Alpha here, which are the younger ones, Gen Z, Gen Y, Gen X, baby boomers, builders, and you can see, you can go onto the Mark McCrindle website, by the way, you can get, download this infographic. But it just helps remind us that we are formed by the experiences and the exposures that we grew up with. So I didn't grow up with technology initially, but I've embraced it. But our Gen Alpha and our Gen Zs, that's all they've known as they've grown up. They grew up with a phone coming as they were coming out of the womb. And it's such a different focus on life. Before World War II, we have those who were born 1946, before World War II, and they had a different life, different exposure to things. You know, they enjoyed, you know, Mustangs and Frisbees and audio cassettes, you know, if you ever even know what those are. We have all these different things that happen in our lives around us. But despite the generations that we have here, even in this congregation here today, we are all still asking the same question. Where is my life going? Whether I'm 80, whether I'm 12, whether I'm 3, haven't quite contemplated it yet, they're saying, where's my life going? I want my next meal, thanks, you know. So they're thinking differently. But we are all asking that question. Ecclesiastes 24:2-24-25, our next slide, had read out before, is a very sobering statement for us. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. If we read these passages of scripture that constantly come through Ecclesiastes, we could be quite depressed by the end of this book. However, you can read this more optimistically as well. Can you see where the optimism comes in? It comes in with the connection to God. The pessimism is without God. But our hope and a trust in him leads us to something more significant, that what you do now has value and worth because of our connection with God. You see, our world wants to pull us down. It doesn't want to see that you are contributed to this world because you're not getting paid for it. So therefore, the home duties, the retirees, the students are feeling like, well, I'm not a contributor. That is a false narrative, and it can make us feel pessimistic. Because our world in which we live, the secularized society of Australia and the Western world, is big on saying that you contribute to our world economically. When you do this, and you pay these taxes, you get this amount of money, then you're a contributor. That is false. It is not the biblical picture. Take it out of our minds. Stand against it fervently. Where is my life going? Connected with God, it's going to go somewhere very differently and be perceived very differently to the person who's striving in this world, trying to pay mortgages and working to survive. God gave us work to thrive, not just survive. Romans 5:3-5 reminds us that there are challenges in life. And it's like, Keith, that sounds fine for you. You've probably had a great life. Everything's been going well for you. You know, it's all good. Guess what? No. I grew up in a very challenged household. And there are many people here who would have gone through many sufferings and challenges over the years. Romans 5:3-5 reminds us, we also glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character hope, and hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured out into the hearts through the Holy Spirit who's been given to us. We see the anomalies in the book of Ecclesiastes and we can go, I hope that isn't me when we read the stories. The reality is, for some of us, it is us. We live in the challenges every day. We live in those sufferings. And sometimes we're being fed this narrative, even in our Christian faith, that you've got to get rid of all the bad stuff that you go through in life. You heard that? certainly coming through our education system, certainly coming in our world now. Oh, that's pretty hard for you. Let's take it away. Oh, that sounds quite a challenge and quite a struggle. Let's take that away. Let's make it easier for you. Where's the resilience? Where's the development where we sit with that? I mean, in my Bible, God doesn't take his people out of the situation. He walks with them through it. We started this service talking about the presence of God. Thank you. The presence is always there. He's not more present today, because it's Sunday, than tomorrow when you go to paid work or domestic work or study or retired work, whatever it is, however you define it. It's about being a realization of his presence in your life right now. His Holy Spirit is always there. It's not more imbued because everyone's together. We just become more aware of his presence in those situations. We need to have, as I say as a practical and pastoral theologian, a theology of suffering. We sometimes need to go through the suffering because, as our passage in Romans 5 reminds us, perseverance is going to build character and character hope, and hope does not disappoint. So it's so easy just to want to get out of situations. But we realize, Ecclesiastes reminds us, hard situations are going to come. Ecclesiastes is one of those books that looks at the realities of life's challenges and helps us to connect it back to God. Because with God, his presence and a reminder of that, and his people, helps us move forward. Today, I guess we're more fortunate. We sit with a fuller revelation than when the writer of this book of Ecclesiastes hit the original readers. We live at a time where we have the resurrection of Jesus' life, death, and his resurrection here for us. We live out of that place. People of the Old Testament were only longing for that, whatever that was even going to look like. They didn't even know what the Messiah or Jesus, this Jesus guy, was going to be. But we do. And so the challenge for us is, will we finish life well? The end of book of Ecclesiastes reminds us of many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Now, that's not saying don't study. So if you're doing HSC or some sort of study, don't not study, okay? It's not saying that. Now, all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all humankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. You know, this part of the scriptures is believed to probably been added on by maybe another sage who wrote Ecclesiastes. So some probably added this on because it's quite a different literary style. Once again, go to Morling, you'll find out all about it. But the great thing about this is it really sums it all up for us. Our connection to God. That's the last word. God in your life. Not in a fearful, judgmental, horrible way that sometimes we can read the Old Testament through the lens of. No, this is about encouragement of God with us in our lives and who we are. And so we operate in finishing life well by connecting with God's mission. We know that from the New Testament picture that we have, the calling of us into doing what God wants us to do. And I think as we think about that, we can sometimes get that mixed up. See, Matthew 16:18 says, "Now I say to you that you are Peter," this is Jesus speaking, which means rock, "and upon this rock I will build my church, and all the powers of hell will not conquer it." We read that and we sometimes think, oh, we should be building the church. Is that what it said? It did not say for us to build the church. Upon Peter, I will build my church. So on the disciples and their work, he builds the church. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 3:7, Paul reminds the Corinthians that each person has a role as a seed sower or a waterer or a nurturer. But who brings the growth? Christ. He brings the growth. Now, let's stop now and think. Let's take the wisdom of Ecclesiastes and think as New Testament people living in the now and not yet. Why do we keep wanting to build the church when it's God's job? In fact, Matthew 28:19-20 makes it quite clear to us. And I think because we haven't stopped over these last few decades as churches throughout the West, we've missed something that has been there before our eyes all the time. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. You know what it's about? Discipleship. But sometimes we can put so much pressure onto certain people, certain leaders. Oh, it's your responsibility to make sure you build the church. Oh, the church isn't growing, it's your fault. Hello. Blame God. He's the one who builds the church. If you're dissatisfied with the church's decline in Australia, which we all are, blame God. But then turn the torch onto ourselves. Are we doing our role and function, which is discipleship? You see, the book of Ecclesiastes is a book of discipleship. It's a book about helping people through their lifespan, and we can all disciple somebody else. We all have an opportunity to help somebody else. That's what we're called to. And we can read Ecclesiastes and be reminded of the life that's up and down. And as we sit with people, helping them to work through, oh, I'm going through this life change at the moment. I don't know where I'm going. And we're there as a discipler of them. We're sitting with them. We can help them process that because we've probably already answered some of those questions, possibly, for some of those people. The challenge of Ecclesiastes is to all of us. Who are you discipling? Who are you imparting into one-on-one or in small groups or whatever it is? And who is doing that to you? Who have you allowed directly to have access to speak into your life, to encourage you and help you through your life challenges? I said earlier that my life has been very challenged in my growing up. And I know it was through having someone speak into my life that I've been able to move to a place that I never thought I would ever believe to even think I could get to. Now, there's still more work to be done. But because I allowed someone who's just a little bit ahead of me in life speak into my life, and I do that with others, and I speak into theirs. And we see those people growing, and we see those people staying in faith. They're not wandering from the church. I haven't wandered from the church, even many times I could have, because there was people there speaking to my life. If you're turning up to church on a Sunday and expect everything to be done for you, you will be heavily disappointed. Because it's about discipleship. Our time together is a time of celebration and encouragement and mutual awareness of God's presence and celebration and all those great things. And we need that too, to see the bigger picture, that it's not just about me. There's a whole lot of stuff happening. But we do know those people. Who have you got? Ephesians 3:11-13 reminds us that our pastors and our prophets. Next slide, please. Oh, sorry. I'll come back to that one. Can you go ahead to the next slide and then I'll come back to that one? Yeah, that's it. It's the reminder, the fivefold ministry, Ephesians 3:11-13, the equipping to grow. There's people who are there to guide us and direct us and help us to do that. And so pastors do that, apostles, prophets, evangelists, teachers, to equip the body for the works of service. We all do as disciplers of others. We need to have that person in our life. We need to speak into others. And sometimes you might think, well, I don't know how to do that with somebody. I'll just go back to that other slide before this one. Sorry you can't see that on the right. It's a bit dark in this room, sorry. But these are some resources I've found over the years that help us to integrate our faith into everyday life. The London Institute of Contemporary Christianity, which is over on this side at the top, licc.org.uk, has some really great resources of what does it look like to integrate a whole of life together. They've got some Bible study materials you can do as a small group to just say, okay, this is what it could look like. And it's very earthy, very practical sort of stuff. In fact, we actually exported a few Australians over to the LICC to help them out. It used to be the John Stott Institute, if you've know anything about some of the history of some of these. So they're a great organisation over in London, in England. We've got some great books over here. Tim Keller just recently died, unfortunately. But he wrote a pivotal book called Every Good Endeavour, and I'd say start reading that book. especially if you are in a workplace, paid workplace, or, you know, you're doing domestics and that type of thing, and you feel like, oh, I'm working so much, have a read of that book and see the integration of faith and work and how that looks in that journey. And Cara Martin, she's an Australian author. We have her come to the college sometimes. And she's written two books, Worship 1 and Worship 2. Great, really good resources, really easy to read, really good stuff just to help you think and pray about what that might mean. And if you want something a little bit more academic, you can go for the next one, Transforming Vocation. Yours truly is in there. I've got a chapter in there. No self-promotion, of course. And so that's a really good book, and it's a little bit more academic if you want a little bit more thinking power around what that might look like. Amy Sherman's an American lady and works really from within the corporate sphere from Wheaton College. So she's got some really good writing. So there's some good array of male and female writers there that we can connect in with. So I hope today has been a real challenge to you as you think of who are you going to be discipling, or who are you already discipling, and who's speaking into your life, helping you through the life phases that you go through. Ecclesiastes reminds us of the life that we go through. And no matter what age, there's things going on, there's things that are happening, and we just need someone to journey with us in a more direct way. Do you know what I'm saying? Who can just be there with us. So I thought today as a way forward, since this was a book on wisdom, a book that guides us and directs us, that we should all reflect on, I want to sort of stand and finish with this prayer today. It's the Prayer of Serenity by Reinhold Niebuhr. He's a Lutheran theologian from last century, and you may be aware of this prayer. Very simple, beautiful prayer. The number of times I pray it is probably, you know, nearly every day. It's a matter of how many times a day I pray it. It's a simple little prayer. That reminds us that there's things in our world we can't change. How do we accept those? How do we grow through them? You know, those sort of things, those challenges. How do we sit in that space, which is really challenging? How do we move forward instead of being taken out of it? And what are the things that we can be courageous to change? And think, yeah, that could be changed. I'm going to do that. But the wisdom between it. Do you understand where we're going?